The Milwaukee Bucks are getting one last day off before getting back to regular season play tomorrow night. Heading into this week's NBA All-Star break, the Bucks are 43-14. It's good enough for not only the best record in the Eastern Conference, but the entire league. And they're led by a top candidate for NBA MVP, Giannis Antetokounmpo. But do the Bucks have what it takes to make a deep playoff run, maybe even a shot at a championship? Central Time producer Bill Martin spoke earlier today with Ted Davis, the radio play-by-play announcer for the Bucks.
The numbers for the Bucks so far look really good this year. They've got the best record in the league. They've yet to lose back-to-back games. They've got the NBA's top-rated defense, I think the fourth-best offense. Can you give us some context beyond those stats as to just how good the Bucks have been this season?
Well, you pointed out they've got the best record in the league. They've been able to win at home in their new arena. They are 20-9 on the road, which is already one more road win than they had all of last season. They are 30-8 against the Eastern Conference. They have won seven straight road games. They are 11-1 in their division. I think they're seven games over 500 against the Western Conference. And so they've been good from start to finish. And as you pointed out, they have not lost two in a row. They're the only team in the league that hasn't lost two in a row. They're 14-0 after they lose a game, and they've won those games by an average of about 13 points per game. They are, I think, now 9-0 in rematch games. That's when they play a team that had beaten them the time before. They're 9-0 when they rematch against the team that had beaten them, and the margin of victory in those games is about 20, and at 9.8 per game difference, they lead the league in that category, too. They're the best rebounding team of the league. They're second in offense. They're the number one rated defensive team. They have been good from start to finish.
Is there anything they're not doing well?
I think defending the three. I think if there's one thing that Mike Budenholzer has talked about improving, they still give up a lot of threes. And some of it is by design, the way they drop their big men back in the lane to try to protect the rim. And they've done a very good job of that. The Bucks have a very good defensive field goal percentage inside the paint this year. But they're giving up about 13 threes per game on average. That's the most in the NBA. And I would say in the last 25 games, if Budenholzer could wave a magic wand and improve on something, I think that would be it.
Speaking of threes, the Bucks are shooting way more three-pointers this year than in previous years. Is that a new philosophy that Coach Budenholzer brought to the team?
Well, yeah, it's his philosophy because that's the way he played in Atlanta. Really, when you look at what he's doing now, Brook Lopez became he became Al Horford. Al Horford was the big guy that shot outside in Atlanta. And they've already broken the single-season record for made three-pointers in a game, and they did that, I think, in 55 games. And the other record was, of course, over an 82-game schedule. So when Budenholzer took the job, this was by design. He was going to come in, and he knew he had this very unique talent in Giannis Antetokounmpo and his ability to free himself up and score around the rim. And so what he wanted to do was put as many shooters as he can around Giannis to space the floor and give Giannis as much room to operate in the paint as he could. And if you notice what the Bucks do, they have, at all times, four guys who can shoot threes and make threes with Giannis on the floor. Now, what we found out as the year has gone on is that not only has that helped Giannis, but it's helped Chris Middleton, who's got a good mid-range game. It's helped Eric Bledsoe drive to the basket. So with the attention that Giannis gets, if you can spread the floor, hit some threes, your offense is going to be good both at the three-point line and around the rim.
Giannis just keeps getting better and better. What makes him such a special player, do you think?
The most unique set of athletic skills that I have seen in my 31 years of covering the NBA. And that says a lot. That's a lot of players. There have been some really athletic guys. Michael Jordan, Dr. J, LeBron James. Just go down the list of athletic guys. Dominique Wilkins. But none of them had the size that Giannis has at almost 7 feet, with the ability to cover the ground that he covers in one or two steps, the ability to handle the basketball at his size like a guard, the vision of a point guard, and at 7 feet, the ability to see over defenses. And I'm not saying he's the best player in the league right now. I think Kevin Durant's a more polished offensive player in terms of his outside shooting. Steph Curry is a great shooter. Klay Thompson, James Harden is such a scorer. But I'm just saying, from pure raw athletic ability, he is the most unique athlete I have seen in my time in the NBA. He's getting better every year, and I think he's getting better every game. And he's only 24. And I've always heard that NBA coaches and NBA personnel have said that a player's prime years are between the ages of 24 and about 32. That's when you get your maximum production from a player, because they've grown into their body, they've learned how to play the game, and now they can maximize their skills. Well, if that's true, then Giannis is just now going into his prime years, and he's pretty dang good right now.
Yeah, that's scary to think about. I'm glad he's on our side. We're talking with Ted Davis, the voice of the Bucks Radio Network. Ted, the NBA trade deadline was a couple of weeks ago. The Bucks made a deal with the Pelicans for Nikola Mirotic, and they really didn't have to give up a whole lot in return. That was a pretty big pickup. What does he bring to the Bucks?
Another shooter, another guy that they can put out there and give Giannis more room. And not only is Mirotic a three-point shooter, but he is a deep three-point shooter, just like Brook Lopez. If you watch the Bucks play, sometimes Lopez will take a three-pointer that seems like, you go, wow, why is he shooting it that far out? Well, number one, he's got the range, but again, that pulls the defense even farther away from the lane area, which is where the Bucks want to free Giannis up. And Mirotic can do the same thing. I think it was a steal for what they had to give up. They didn't give up anything that they've been using in their rotation. And if Mirotic can play the way he did in the playoffs last year for the New Orleans Pelicans, when they, as a lower seed, upset a higher seed Portland team, he was really good in that series. If he can play like this in the final 25 games for the Bucks are going to be absolutely a dangerous and tough out at playoff time, and I think poised to make a deep run into the playoffs.
Mirotic hasn't seen any action since joining the team because he's got a calf injury, I guess. When might we finally see him play?
I think there's a really high possibility that he could play tomorrow, Thursday night, when the Bucks are home against the Boston Celtics. I think he was close in Indiana the last game before the All-Star break, and I think the medical staff said, you know what, if we don't play him tonight, we've got another week to let him rest. And then, they're having a practice session on Wednesday afternoon. I think if he gets through that okay in the shoot-around on Thursday morning, I think we'll see Mirotic on Thursday.
And he's going to be coming off the bench, right? He's not going to be a starter?
For now. I mean, they'll keep what they've got. The starters are Middleton, Bledsoe, Brogdon, Giannis, and Lopez. So I think they'll stick with that.
So we've got 24 regular season games left, then the playoffs. Let's assume they get in. You know, the postseason hasn't been great for the Bucks in recent years. In fact, I don't think they've won a first-round series since, like, 2001. They say experience matters. Might that lack of experience and maybe lack of success be a problem this time around, or maybe not?
Well, I don't think so, because this has been kind of a building process for the Bucks. 2 years ago, they played Toronto in the playoffs. They went up 2-1 in the series, winning a game in Toronto to open that series. And then last year they played the Boston Celtics, and that went 7. And the Bucks won all 3 home games and lost all 4 road games. I think there's a learning process that you go through when you go through a series like that. So now here are the Bucks in the third year of this process. And I think in particular, if they can get home court advantage in the first round, or if they maintain their position now and have home court advantage all the way through the Eastern Conference Finals, then that gives them a great opportunity to make this deep run. So I think all the things that have happened in the last 2 to 3 years have led them to be where they are now. And I'm aware of the fact that right now they're a really good regular season team. But greatness is defined by what a team does in the playoffs. And for this team to be considered to have a great season, they're going to have to make a deep run into the playoffs, and I think right now that probably is at least the Eastern Conference Finals.
Which team is going to give the Bucks the biggest challenge the rest of the way, especially in the East?
You know, I haven't seen Philadelphia since they made the trade. We've only played Philadelphia one time this year. It was very early in the season. The Bucks blew them out at Fiserv Forum. But, you know, adding Tobias Harris to what is already a potent offense, I think they could be dangerous. I'd like to see them again. The Bucks play them 2 times before the end of the season, and that'll be a better measuring stick. I keep thinking Boston's going to get their act together, but at the moment, they're 7 games in the loss column behind the Bucks. That's a lot to make up in the games that the Bucks have left to play. I still think Toronto in a seven-game series would be a tough out, even though the Bucks have won three of the four regular season games and won twice in Toronto. They've got some bigs in Pascal Siakam and Serge Ibaka that have given the Bucks trouble. I think the addition of Marc Gasol has added a different element to their center position, and Kawhi Leonard can be a tough guy at playoff time. So if you're going to make me pick right now, I would say Toronto.
Okay. Ted Davis, appreciate your time. Thank you so much for helping us out today.
All right, thank you.
Ted Davis is the voice of the Milwaukee Bucks Radio Network. He talked to Bill Martins about the team's success so far this season. The Bucks tip off the unofficial second half of the season tomorrow night at home against the Boston Celtics. Governor Tony Evers is set to propose his first state budget next week, and transportation funding will be a big priority. When it comes to funding at the state level, conversation often centers around fixing roads and expanding highways. But our next guest says if we want to meet the transportation needs of the millennial generation, we need to start paying attention to options like biking and public transportation. Emma Fisher is an organizer for the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group. She co-authored the group's recent study on transportation trends in Wisconsin called Millennials on the Move. Emma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me here.
Before we get to your report, would it be fair to say that most of our transportation in Wisconsin is on the car-centric side?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
What do you see out there when you look at the annual debates over or biannual debates over transportation funding?
Yeah, I mean, over the past couple budget cycles, the debate has revolved around expanding highways and how much funding we have to dedicate to this purpose, how much debt we should take on, and whether or not these investments will require an increase in revenue. But we really think that the conversation should be about our priorities and what we're spending that money on. We need to rethink just spending that money on roads and expanding highways. And instead, we should be thinking about investing in the types of non-driving options, like really good, robust public transportation systems and walking and biking infrastructure across the state that will help people get where they need to go and help make life better for everyone in Wisconsin. And as we talk about in our report, help make Wisconsin a more attractive place for young people to live.
And to that end, you went out and surveyed some people, younger people. Tell us a little bit about the survey and what you were hoping to find out.
Yeah, that's right. So we surveyed over 600 college students in Wisconsin across 24 campuses. This was in the 2017-2018 school year. And we recently released the results in our new report, Millennials on the Move. And what we found is that young people today have different transportation preferences than did previous generations of young people, and that more and more young people are seeking out lifestyles where they're able to get around, not just by driving, but by walking, biking, or taking public transportation. And that they're even willing, in many cases, to act on these preferences and are moving to places that accommodate these lifestyles. So our study found that 75% of our respondents in Wisconsin said that access to good non-driving transportation options might affect their decisions about where to live after graduation. And 55% said that this may actually affect whether or not they decide to stay in Wisconsin.
And what were the attitudes toward car ownership like among the people you surveyed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Despite, this overwhelming desire for more good public transportation options in Wisconsin, 85% of respondents said that they do still plan to own a car after graduation. And, it's still necessary to own a car to get around in many places. But more and more young people see owning or relying on a car as a burden and an expense, kind of something that they have to do, not that they want to do. And so being able to get around by walking, biking, or taking the bus actually allows for multitasking and socializing and can enable a higher quality of life than being dependent on a car to get everywhere.
Now, your survey was just college students, I think. Do you worry that that might not be representative of the entire generation as a whole, college and non?
Yeah, so our survey was just college students in Wisconsin, but our study as a whole looked at millennials in general and young people. And many studies of the millennial generation and young people are showing the same trends, that millennials and young people want to live in places where they have, vibrant downtown areas and access to a wide range of transportation options and mixed-use development, the ability to get the places they need and want to go, to get to work, social opportunities, and run errands within close proximity. So an interesting study by the Rockefeller Foundation in 2014 found that that millennials, people ages 18 to 34, ranked good transportation options as one of their top three criteria for deciding where to live. So that's broadening it out beyond students.
Talking to Emma Fisher with the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group, talking about the group's recent report on transportation trends in Wisconsin called Millennials on the Move. Emma, in this report, as you said, you're making the case that this is something, and you're hearing from younger people, that these transportation options will determine where they want to live in many cases. Do you see communities running with this idea, saying, okay, if we want to keep young people, attract young people, we need to do these particular things?
Yeah, our report profiles three examples of communities in Wisconsin that are already doing these things, that are taking seriously the need for more multimodal walking, biking, and public transportation options, and that are really seeing the benefits. So one of these cities is Eau Claire. After a major loss of jobs in the 1990s, Eau Claire really committed to revitalizing downtown, investing in a bike network, a trail system, and public transportation to connect the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire to downtown and to bring, you know, more restaurants and parks and just good public transportation and biking and walking systems to revitalize that city. And now Eau Claire is the second fastest growing city in Wisconsin and has one-third of its population are people between ages of 20 and 34.
And what were the other two communities you looked at?
We also looked at La Crosse and Madison. I live in Madison, and I don't have a car. I get to benefit from the ability to walk, bike, and take the bus everywhere. And Madison is actually the U.S. city with the fifth highest percentage of millennials, which is really impressive. And I think it really shows that Madison's serious commitment to its good bus system, public transportation, walking, and biking is definitely paying off.
I think sometimes people think of paying for public transportation as an economic burden, a fiscal burden on a city. Are you hoping to change the narrative here so we think about it as an economic development tool?
Yeah, absolutely. I think cities like Eau Claire, La Crosse, and Madison do look at it that way. And like I said, they're definitely seeing the benefits. Having a good public transportation system is not just good for young people. It improves quality of life for everyone and can really be a tool to help our cities thrive, especially in the 21st century.
I'm going to bring a caller on now. Liam is with us in Appleton. Liam, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Liam.
I was just listening to WPR, and I heard you were talking about the millennial preferences in transportation. I just wanted to say that personally, I think that a comprehensive bus system and more bike lanes here in Appleton and throughout Wisconsin would be fantastic.
All right, Liam, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Do you hear this anecdotally outside of your surveys from people living in communities? I want to see more of this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, another student up in the Fox Valley who I surveyed and worked with told me that, you know, having access to a bus system in Appleton would possibly make her more likely to stay in Wisconsin. She's a student from Minneapolis originally and didn't get her driver's license because she didn't need it there and thought she wouldn't need it in college, and now feels like her freedom is limited and, you know, is really stuck on campus, which is really unfortunate. So definitely, I think a lot of students are just like looking for better ways to get around.
I've talked to people who look at these issues in southeastern Wisconsin who have focused on the idea that transportation is an equity issue. Poorer people can't necessarily afford a reliable car to get to jobs. If you wanted to get from, say, a high unemployment area in Milwaukee to, say, a Foxconn development not that far away without a car, can you talk about the value of public transportation for that kind of issue?
Yeah, absolutely. This gets back to your earlier question about using transportation as an economic development tool. And I mean, it's a huge quality of life thing. If people aren't able to get where they need to go, then that, you know, can prevent people from having a job, from getting to the doctor. So it's really important that we're giving people ways to get where they need to go, whether or not they can or choose to drive. And so we should be investing in a transportation system that can do that, not just continuing down the path of widening highways at the expense of these other really important systems.
Now, there might be people listening saying, okay, this is all well and good, but I rely on a car. Everyone I know relies on a car. Please don't take away transportation money from a good, reliable road system. I lose, other people gain in that case.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, we think that we should be prioritizing fix it first. We should be investing in repairing and maintaining our existing local roads and bridges that we already have. Funding for repairing local roads has also stagnated at the expense of these mega highway projects. So we should definitely be investing in maintaining our local roads. We should also be prioritizing a robust public transportation system and walking and biking infrastructure, not just continuing down the same path of widening highways.
As I mentioned right at the start, Governor Evers getting ready to release his budget. State lawmakers will get a crack at either revising his budget or coming up with their own. What are you hoping for in this particular budget cycle?
Yeah, we want to see, regardless of how much revenue we have coming in, that we are getting our transportation spending priorities straight, having a modern and effective 21st century transportation system that makes life better for everyone and will help make our state more attractive to young people will mean we need to be investing in creating the types of walkable, bikeable, and transit-friendly communities that can bring these benefits to our state, not just pouring money into adding lanes to highways, as I've said.
Emma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Emma Fisher, an organizer for the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group. She was with us to talk about changes in how millennials in Wisconsin want to get around and what that means for the state's transportation system. As we mentioned, that state budget will be coming out next week. We'll be watching for that and talking about that on Central Time and on the morning show here on the Ideas Network. It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. There's ongoing fallout and calls for an investigation after claims made by former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe in a recently televised interview. Meanwhile, House Democrats are launching an investigation into the Trump administration's dealings with Saudi Arabia. Members of Congress are responding to the president's declaration of a national emergency on the southern border, and a familiar face jumps into the 2020 presidential race. Our question for you this week, how do you feel about that national emergency declaration at the southern border? Does this free up necessary funds for a wall, or is this an abuse of presidential powers? How would you like to see Democrats and Republicans respond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start off with Andrew McCabe, former acting FBI director. This interview on 60 Minutes got a lot of attention. McCabe said it's possible that President Trump could be a Russian asset, mentioned that there was a brief conversation about using the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office. What all have we heard from McCabe since then?
Well, that's right. There's a lot to unpack there, and he has been, in fact, making the media rounds promoting his new book on his time at the FBI and in dealing with President Trump. I think one additional takeaway is this idea that he, in this revelation, that he says he went ahead and briefed the members of Congress known as the Gang of Eight, the top eight officials on intelligence matters, including Paul Ryan at the time, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. He says he briefed them back in 2017 that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation into the president about whether he was, in fact, working for the Russian government, as you mentioned, this idea of him being a Russian asset. And so I thought that was significant. He says there was zero pushback. Nobody questioned it when he brought that to their attention. And so I think that's significant, and I think that's something that's going to be looked at by members of Congress going forward.
Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina responding to McCabe's comments about the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment. Here's a listen.
We're going to find out what happened here, and the only way I know to find out is to call the people in under oath and find out, you know, through questioning, who's telling the truth, because the underlying accusation is beyond stunning.
Can you talk about congressional reaction now to that McCabe interview, including what we just heard there from Senator Graham?
Well, obviously, Trump's allies, including Lindsey Graham and Mark Meadows, the Freedom Caucus chairman, they're very upset at this idea that there was a conversation between McCabe and the deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. This would have been after James Comey's firing, but the fact that there was a discussion happening within DOJ and the FBI raising the specter of invoking the 25th Amendment. And as you know, and your listeners know, that would trigger a process of actually removing a president from office who, you know, who his cabinet deems unfit to carry out his duties. And so these were, according to McCabe, real conversations that were happening. And, you know, let's just take a step back. I mean, we're talking about this idea of removing a president from office under the 25th Amendment. We're talking about this idea that people believed the president was a Russian asset. I mean, you know, it's sort of something out of, you know, some kind of mystery thriller movie or something like that. But these were real conversations that were, in fact, happening.
And now the New York Times put out a report this week, extensive report about pressure from President Trump and his administration, allies in Congress to protect the president from various investigations, including the Mueller probe, including Southern District of New York investigations. What were some of the key takeaways from that report?
Right. The Times reported that the president actually called late last year. He called his acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, to see if he could intervene and install a key Trump ally named Jeffrey Berman, who happens to be the top prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, to oversee this Michael Cohen case. This was, as your listeners will remember, this is the case about hush money payments to silence women who had alleged affairs with then-candidate Trump back in the 2016 campaign. And so it's raising more concerns that the president has engaged in obstruction of justice. Normally, a president will steer clear of investigations, especially when he appears to be the target of that investigation. But in this case, Trump is very much has taken a hands-on posture, and that is raising concerns from members of Congress, including Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, who says if these reports are true, then this is a clear case of obstruction of justice, and has even called for the president to resign.
And earlier today, the president responded to the New York Times report, tweeting, "The New York Times reporting is false. They are a true enemy of the people," enemy of the people in all caps there. The president doesn't say specifically what he thinks the New York Times got wrong, but clearly not happy with this report.
Yeah, this is just more of you know, Trump's aggressive stance against not only the New York Times but the Washington Post and what he sees as the mainstream media at large, and obviously folks in journalism like myself and others believe that this is creating a very dangerous, you know, these are very dangerous types of words and rhetoric aimed against journalists at a time when a lot of journalists are under threat. And so we don't think it's very helpful, but the president has taken this position and posture against the press when he feels he is being unfairly covered.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Well, maybe the biggest story of the last week or so, Scott, this national emergency declaration from the president saying it allows him to tap into money intended for other things, military construction and more, to fund construction on the U.S.-Mexico border. What are we seeing? We have this lawsuit now from a bunch of states, not including Wisconsin, not yet anyway. What are you hearing from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, I think you're seeing this sort of, you know, dual track of opposition forming, one with these lawsuits from California and other states, 16 states across the country. The second track is obviously opposition in Congress. And what we're seeing right now is the House of Representatives, led by Democrats, preparing a resolution of disapproval, essentially, that would block the president from going down this path of using his executive power to declare this national emergency at the border. And we're hearing that this resolution is going to be introduced as soon as Friday. We could see a vote in the House as early as next week. This is being led by Joaquin Castro, who is the brother of Julian Castro, who is running for president, as well as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the sort of liberal freshman firebrand from New York. And so they've already collected 90 signatures. it will clear the House easily because that's led by Democrats. What we're watching for is what happens in the Senate. And what we think is that all Democrats will be opposed to it, and a number of Republicans will defect from the president and join Democrats in supporting that resolution that will, again, create another standoff between Congress and the president of the United States over this issue. What remains to be seen is how many Republicans, you know, cross the aisle and join with Democrats. The main concern, I think, from Republicans that we've heard of in the Senate is they think this sets a incredibly bad precedent for future presidents, especially if you have a Democratic president. They're warning, the Republicans are warning, that if you have a Democratic president, they could simply declare a national emergency on climate change or a national emergency, you know, in terms of the gun violence epidemic. And they think it just sets a horrible precedent and takes power away from the Congress.
And do I have this right procedurally, Scott? I think I've read that the form of this resolution means that if the House passes it, the Senate actually has to vote on it. So Mitch McConnell, say, couldn't just let it ride and not bring it to a vote.
I think that's right. I think there, you know, based on some of the reporting I saw, there was a conversation between Mitch McConnell and the president last week, where McConnell basically told the president, "Look, we will support you in this declaration, this emergency declaration on the border, but you have to know that we likely will have to take up a resolution of disapproval and." McConnell is saying to the president, basically, I may lose some Republicans in that vote, and you just have to be well aware of what you're getting yourself into.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's our weekly roundup of national political news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this issue we're talking about now, the president's national emergency declaration to free up funding for a border wall. How do you feel about this? What do you want to see from Democrats and Republicans in Congress? Should they pass this resolution of disapproval? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. We're digging into some of the latest national political news. We were talking about the emergency declaration and the congressional response. We had an email from Jim. Jim says, why isn't anyone talking about the abject mean-spiritedness of Trump shutting down government for 34 days if the emergency order was an option to begin with? Hundreds of thousands of people were facing real-world issues with finances all for nothing. Has that been a point of criticism, Scott? Like, why not just make that emergency declaration instead of the shutdown in the first place?
Yeah, a lot of people have said, look, Trump could have done this before we all went through this 35-day shutdown, the longest shutdown in U.S. history. In fact, what Democrats had offered on the table in terms of border security, in terms of a border security package, was actually more substantial than what President Trump ultimately got after the 35-day shutdown. And so people have certainly made that argument. Obviously, a lot of thousands of Americans, you know, federal government workers as well as contractors, went through a lot of pain when we went through that shutdown, and I think everyone was simply relieved that we didn't enter a second shutdown last week.
Let's bring on a caller before we move on to other issues. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hello.
Hello, yes. My comment was just that it's really important for us to take back the government. I don't care which party is in office. There are branches of the government for a reason, and they were set up by the framers for exactly that purpose. We really need to have people understand they cannot be the king in this country, because this is not a kingdom, it is a democracy, and we that just because you don't get the funding, it doesn't mean that you call this a national security issue. And I actually believe climate change is a bigger national security issue than the border wall. So
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. And some members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation, including Republicans like James Sensenbrenner, are raising some of those separation of powers issues. It's also part of the lawsuit by multiple states. Scott, this is a fundamental issue in this argument.
Well, that's right. And, you know, sort of to what to the caller's point, I think when you look at the recent polling, one poll came out, NPR, PBS, Marist poll showed that while 85% of Republicans do back Trump's executive action, the majority of Americans, 60%, are opposed. And 60% of Americans also say there's no emergency at the border, as Trump insists. And another 60% say that the move should be challenged in the courts. And so while this appeals to Trump's base ahead of the 2020 election, that's something he's trying to energize his voters and energize his base and get them out to the polls before 2020, he's losing nearly all Democrats and a lot of independent voters that will be very important in the general election. We're of course, a long ways away from the 2020 election, but these are some of the things to be thinking about heading into that race.
Thanks for the call, Susan. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Scott, Democrats on the House Oversight and Reform Committee say they're launching an investigation into the Trump administration's dealings with Saudi Arabia as related to nuclear energy technology. Can you give us some of the background on that?
Yeah, just real quick, you know, this is another example of Congress demonstrating and sort of asserting itself that it's not happy with the Trump administration's coziness with the Saudi royal family and the government. The Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings this week said his company would be diving into an investigation into Trump political appointees who they said are rushing to provide nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia, while there were a number of ethical and legal professionals in government sounding the alarm bells about this potential move. And so, you know, it really comes against this backdrop of the killing of the U.S.-based journalist from the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, which intelligence officials insist that the Saudi crown prince had something to do with this, that he ordered Khashoggi to be murdered in the embassy in Turkey. And a number of folks in Congress and the intelligence community believe Trump has not spoken out aggressively enough against the crown prince, bin Salman. And so, there's a number of sort of geopolitical issues here, but also sort of speaks to the relationship between Congress and Trump when it comes to foreign policy, particularly with the Saudi government.
And retired General Michael Flynn is at the center of this story, as he has been in a lot of other stories over the last few years. He, during the transition, he was also apparently consulting with a nuclear energy group that was hoping to do this, to help Saudi Arabia build nuclear power plants. So that's a name that maybe the Trump administration doesn't want to see back in the news again.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned Michael Flynn. I mean, he's sort of the nexus, between this Saudi nuclear deal as well as the Russia probe that Robert Mueller has been focusing on. And I think Flynn was one of the earliest indictments in that probe. And so it's a familiar name. It's a name we haven't heard about, quite frankly, in a while. But it's certainly interesting, and one other aspect to this with members of Congress and lawmakers trying to assert their authority in terms of the balance of powers with the president, the House and Senate have also passed this resolution to force Trump to restrict U.S. troops in the Saudi coalition that's fighting in the civil war in Yemen. It's all sort of related, but Trump has opposed this resolution, and so the way things are looking right now, this will likely set up the first veto of the Trump presidency. That could be coming in a number of weeks.
And finally, Scott, you mentioned the presidential election in some ways is a long way away, but news keeps coming out each and every day. A familiar face and voice joined the roster of 2020 Democratic hopefuls this week. Here's a listen.
Somebody can come before you and say, look, I want to do A and I want to do B, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, the only way that real change takes place is when millions of people stand up, fight back, and say, enough is enough. We're going to have a government that works for all of us, not just the few.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders there in a non-surprise announcement saying he's having another go at running for president. Can you talk about Bernie Sanders' role in this growing Democratic field, Scott?
Well, he made a big splash this week, and we had, as you mentioned, been expecting him to jump in, but the big surprise was the amount of money that he was able to raise in the first 24 hours. You know, after Kamala Harris of California dove into the race a few weeks ago, she announced a big fundraising haul of $1.5 million in her first 24 hours to sort of demonstrate the excitement behind her campaign and that she had a lot of momentum as the primaries take off. Well, Bernie hauled in close to $6 million in the first 24 hours of his announcement, dwarfing Kamala Harris's and most and all of the other candidates who have jumped in so far. And so he's saying, look, I'm a force to be reckoned with. I have energy. I've captured the energy on the left. You know, this is going to be probably a battle of liberals as they seek the Democratic nomination in 2020. And Bernie is saying, you know, I've got a lot of momentum and I am a force to be reckoned with.
It is different this time around with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. He could portray himself as really the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and their standard bearer. There's a lot of candidates and a lot of them in that same sort of ideological terrain this time around, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that sort of speaks to this idea that maybe there's room for somebody, a more moderate, pragmatic candidate, to sort of, you know, cruise up the middle, and while the folks on the left are battling it out, somebody could sneak by and possibly win the primary. It might be a little far-fetched, but, you know, it's entirely possible. One thing we noticed in the past week was Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, who also announced she's running for president. One thing that stood out during one of her town halls is she said she was not for free four-year college education, like many of the other candidates have been. She basically said it's something that she would love to see happen, but she's a realist, and it simply was something that the country could not afford at this time. So I'd be watching Klobuchar to see if she tries to take up space in the middle as other folks are duking it out on the left.
And somebody was pointing out that around this point in the last Republican primary, Jeb Bush and Scott Walker were seen as the big front runners. So maybe it's too soon to make predictions, right, Scott?
I think so. And when you talk to a lot of members of Congress in terms of who they're supporting or endorsing in the primary, sure, you have the Vermont lawmakers who are backing Bernie and a handful of California lawmakers who are backing Kamala Harris. But by and large, most people are staying out of it for now because the field is simply too wide open, and they're not sure actually who's going to win the nomination. It's far too early at this point.
Scott, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics. Share your thoughts on these issues. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Sometimes children say the darndest things, and sometimes they eat the weirdest things. Sam Sanders from the NPR show It's Been a Minute invited his Twitter followers to share their weird food habits from when they were kids. Sam shared his own, quoting, when he was 8 years old, he says, "I used to carry a little bottle of apple cider vinegar wherever I went, taking a swig every now and then." Jay Carlisle Larson, producer, you've got your own stories.
I do. I have a couple. I'll start with what I think is the weirder of the two, which is the only snack my grandmother used to give us as kids were slices of American cheese, but I hated the texture, so I just used to shred it up and swallow it whole.
No chewing involved.
Like, no chewing, like a snake with, I guess, no teeth.
So that's not the food itself, but the method.
But the method, yeah. But I think my weirdest food thing was that I loved combining chocolate chips with bacon bits. I'm getting a look now about it. And I think I was really ahead of the curve
there. Yeah, because people are putting in bacon in all kinds of desserts now.
Yeah, it really bothered my mom, but I just thought it tasted really good.
You were food fashion forward. Here's some quick reactions to some of the ones that are on this Twitter thing. Sugar and dried onion sandwiches. Would you try it?
No.
No, tortilla chips dipped in the swimming pool. That's a no-brainer. Not a chance.
Yes.
Salted lemon slices.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like okay. Just pickle lemon. I might do that. Dipping uncooked spaghetti into peanut butter.
No.
And then eating it, presumably.
Yeah.
No. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.